Hey, I'm pretty open-minded.
Name a single artist or composer in your collection that predates rock and roll. He thought hard.
Metallica's got a song with an intro that's supposed to be derivative of one composer or another,
he offered with a self-deprecating grin. Lorelei softly shook her head with amusement. Oh, the luxuries that await you.
Fräulein Sophia?
A voice gasped. Lorelei's eyes briefly widened before her cool self-assurance reasserted herself. She and Alex turned toward the voice, which repeated as if in shock.
Fräulein Sophia.
She was old. The woman wore a matronly, respectable dress in light blues, with hat and gloves and a small purse. Her face and stature and the slight shake in her arms showed the kind of age that could only be born with an indomitable spirit. In truth, for all the years shown by her body, her only real sign of frailty lay in that she was looking at a ghost. The woman had others with her, younger, all of them, though one man was old enough to be Alex's grandfather.
Ima, come, he said.
Alex knew the word. Jason's family often spoke Hebrew at home. The old man's height made the notion that he could be her son seem a touch comical, almost, were it not for her grave expression and his obvious concern. They were all much taller, though, Alex realized, much taller and healthier, born and raised in dramatically better times.
I'm sorry?
Lorelei asked, blinking in confusion.
You could be her twin,
the elderly woman mumbled, still in shock.
You look so much like her, just like her, during the camp, with that laugh.
Alex heard more than surprise in her tone. The elderly woman's voice trembled with fear, or at least the echoes of it.
I am sorry,
her son said. A younger woman, probably his granddaughter, tugged gently at the elderly woman's wrist to lead her away.
Just a misunderstanding, the man added.
No apologies necessary, Lorelei shrugged, showing a face of concern and compassion. She looked down, though, as they led the woman away to their large family table. Her eyes came up to her dates, again only with reluctance. For the first time, he seemed far away. Somehow, in all of this, their hands had separated.
Alex,
she began softly.
You don't have to explain,
he said, his voice quiet.
Her gloves didn't come up all the way on her wrists. I could see the numbers.
As he spoke, their waiter arrived with their dinner. Alex only nodded his way through the man's perfunctory questions, waiting until he left to speak again.
I've been going to Friday Seder at Jason's since middle school. His grandfather came to speak to my 8th grade class.
He picked up a fork and nudged his steak with disinterest.
History was always one of my better subjects, he mumbled.
Lorelei hesitated.
Alex, I never had any part in what happened to—
I believe you.
He nodded, still quiet. After a moment's silence, he shrugged and looked up at her.
I believe you,
he repeated.
Like, accordingly, right?
Yes.
The glimmer in her eyes had changed. Before, that shine conveyed happiness. Now the light merely shimmered against tears. Beyond Alex, Lorelei saw the woman rise from her table. She brushed off the offers of help, needing nothing more than her cane. She said something in accented Hebrew about just going to the bathroom. She moved off, not looking back.
You were there to punish someone, right?
Alex asked.
I was.
Lorelei's voice seemed to have fled from her. After a moment, Alex said,
I'm not judging you, Lorelei.
She looked at him with pleading eyes, but he just shrugged again.
I wasn't there. You weren't who you are now. I know most of your life was ugly, and I don't see the use in being mad at you for what went on before. I don't want to be mad at you, Lorelei. Holding on to the past when we can't do anything about it just doesn't seem—
He lost that train of thought and shook his head.
I want us to be happy together.
As he spoke,
Lorelai feared their happiness had already vanished.
I'm so sorry.
Alex shook his head.
You don't have to apologize to me.
Silence hung for another long, difficult moment. She understood, of course, that there was no implied message in his words. Still, she said,
No, would you excuse me, Alex?
She waited for him to nod before she got up and headed for the restroom. Lorelai passed by a table, where several men enjoyed drinks after a successful day's sales meetings. A blonde waitress collected their empty glasses, bending at the hips to reach the furthest of them.
Hey, honey,
the man on the end seat slurred.
Can you bring us another round? It's kind of bottoms up time for us.
In his current state, he figured that he was witty. He also figured she'd be flattered to have his hand grab at her ass. An instant later, he figured he should absolutely not cry out as she crushed his fingers together with an iron grip. She stood up straight, holding his hand but otherwise ignoring him. The blonde watched Lorelai until the dark-haired beauty slipped behind the bathroom door. A wry, excited smile played at her lips.
Hot.
She shuddered.
Ow.
Whined the owner of the hand she then released. He knew, despite his overwhelming buzz, that he'd have to get those fingers looked at. He also knew better than to complain when the waitress left without taking their next round of orders. Around the corner from the stalls in the well-appointed ladies' room sat a small cushioned bench. After assuring herself that she was alone, Brigitte sank down onto it. Fräulein Sophia strolled arm in arm with the commander of the camp the last time Brigitte saw her. She wore a fur coat that Brigitte was almost certain was her mother's. She laughed often. They occasionally toured the camp, or at least the less appalling portions of it. Brigitte's memories of Fräulein Sophia and the colonel were all of the two of them towering over her as they passed. Everyone towered over her in those memories. She was on her knees so much, scrubbing and scratching at spots on the floors and the walkways as if her life depended on it. In those days, it had. Fräulein Sophia disappeared one night. So did the colonel. Eventually, a new one took his place. He was somewhat less efficient, which to Brigitte's thinking at the time made him somewhat less cruel. The camp slowed slightly, but noticeably. That did not make her grateful, of course, but she wondered once in a while how few of her people would have lived to see the Red Army arrive if the colonel remained until the end. Perhaps none. It was difficult to say. Time had little meaning in those endless days. It was hard to remember how long the colonel had been there, or how long she lived in the camp after he vanished. Perhaps Fräulein Sophia hadn't been there at all, either. Nothing marked the date for her or the others. The worst part of the camps, after all, was the sense that it would just go on forever until they were all dead. Had anyone known when it would end, had they known the course of the war as it unfolded, perhaps those who expired through hopelessness and sorrow might have been able to hang on. Brigitte wondered about that, and about so many other things, as Fräulein Sophia joined her in the bathroom. Brigitte refused to cower. Not now. Not after so much time, all her old instincts be damned. Not after all these years of prosperity and joy. She was taken by surprise when Fräulein Sophia, clearly stricken, knelt in front of her and bowed her head.
I want to apologize for what is unforgivable, she said in German.
Brigitte said nothing. What could there possibly be to say to this? She was, however, no longer in doubt about this woman. There was no explanation, but in the moment, Brigitte needed none. The question of how just didn't matter.
I came only to punish Jürgen, she said. The colonel. I brought him to his death. His closest officers were removed from their posts because of what followed. They were put on trial and executed for corruption and dereliction of duty, she added, her voice recognizing the bitter irony. The SS were not kind. She looked up, sorrow and remorse plain in her eyes. I apologize to you.
because I see only now how much more I could have done, how much more I should have done, and what was more important than punishment. I could have done more. I could have gone beyond destroying a single man. I believed I laughed in the camp to make Jorgen and his men feel comfortable with me, but the truth is I did not feel at all. I know that now. I could have and should have done so much more. I would have, were I something better than what I was.
Brigitte looked as if she might weep, but did not. Her tears had all been shed a long time ago. They were gone. Fräulein Sophia, though, obviously had a few. They fell as Brigitte spoke.
What are you now? She asked. Something better?
I hope so. I am so very sorry, Lorelei answered. And perhaps that much makes me a little better, yes. I am so very sorry.
You are a bit late for Yom Kippur,
Brigitte observed after a long moment's consideration.
But not by so much, I think.
A text message from Jason with his usual eloquence.
Sup?
Alex responded. Dinner date. Epic fail.
Why dat? Ambushed by Godwin's law.
Good times, read the response. Alex frowned, thinking as he put the phone back in his pocket. Who says text messaging lacks tone? Jason seemed to have that part down. A familiar welcome touch slipped over his shoulder as Lorelei passed him on the return to her seat. He noted an emotional recovery.
Thank you, Alex.
He looked at her curiously.
For what?
For giving me the chance to become someone better than I was, Lorelei answered. Alex glanced over his shoulder to see the little old lady return to her seat with her family. She looked to be in better spirits. Then, remembering his manners, he got up out of his seat and pulled out Lorelei's chair for her. She hadn't expected it. The small courtesy resurrected her smile. He realized as he sat down that he felt pleased all of a sudden, on some instinctive level. He glanced back to the large family and then asked,
You talked to her?
I did.
You know I didn't expect that of you, right? I didn't mean anything by what I said.
It wasn't about you. She nodded. Her hand came out across the table to take his. But you gave me a chance. I never would have thought to ask for it. They looked at one another until Alex said,
I'm going to have a hard time eating with only my left hand.
How do you figure he swung that?
Thomas asked, nodding at the table from his seat at the bar.
Money, gotta be. Rich kid, rich kid's date. Maybe daddy rented her for him for his birthday,
muttered Richard. He took another gulp of his Jack and Coke and looked on with no small amount of open, casual jealousy.
I dunno, man, Harold frowned. I've seen professional escorts before, but she's a cut above all that. Something fishy, though.
Seriously,
Thomas agreed.
What's she doing with him?
Falling in love, said the waitress behind the bar. She didn't look at the three finance office chums. The blonde appeared mostly fixated on the bartender's cheat sheet for mixed drinks.
Get out of here,
Richard huffed.
With him?
Fuck yeah,
she nodded.
He's like my kid nephew. What's he got that's so special?
Harold asked.
He's hot,
the blonde said. Her eyes fluttered closed, and she inhaled deeply as if breathing in some intoxicating fume.
Hot like redemption.
The three men openly gawked at the stunning blonde, utterly mesmerized by her now as she indulged in the moment. They hadn't noticed just how beautiful she was until she spoke, nor had they ever seen anyone's face so erotically charged right in front of them. Harold's mouth hung agape.
That's hot?
Mm-hmm,
she nodded. Her eyes closed and her posture weakened.
I'm afraid to actually look, she admitted breathlessly. I don't know if I can control myself. swept away by the sight. They were all surprised when that look of transcendent arousal shifted to sober, scowling distaste. "Ah, shit," she muttered, her eyes turned toward the entrance. She set the ingredients to whatever she'd been fixing down behind the bar.
"Hey, wait,"
Thomas urged. She paused to look at him quizzically. He wasn't sure what he meant to say, apart from wanting that angelic face to stay with him. Quickly, he grasped for anything to keep her attention.
"Aren't you fixing that drink for someone?"
Rachel glanced at the drink. "Oh, whatever. It's not like I work here." Lorelai sensed the arrival just as it occurred. She had been laughing with Alex, explaining to him after handling the check just how tacky it was to pay with cash in a restaurant like this. That laughter fell away almost instantly. The look in her eyes, like a predator whose territory had been intruded upon, was unmistakable. Alex turned his head a bit to indicate his curiosity. "Demon," Lorelai said quietly. "One that will surely sense my presence."
"Like Gorge?"
"No." Her expression grew darker. "Much worse, one like me. Her name is Lydia." His brow furrowed. Alex felt tense already.
"You can tell one from another?"
"I know this one. Gorge told me she was in Seattle."
"What else did he tell you?"
Lorelai nearly answered, but stopped. "I believe now is not the time. There are a thousand ways this could go poorly. A week ago it would have been no issue, but in my current state this is dangerous. Will you follow my lead?"
"Yeah, of course."
"I cannot hide us. She knows I am here and will discern much. Our only option is to walk out quite brazenly." She looked at him seriously. "Remember all that you have overcome, Alex. Fear no evil." Alex took a deep breath and nodded. He got out of his seat, helped her out of hers, and took her arm. They didn't have far to go. Alex wondered just how far Lorelai had fallen from her original state. He knew what had been taken, and that she had only thus far recovered her devil's tail, but that gave him little perspective. He considered it all one hell of an incentive to have more sex. "If we make it out of here," he thought. Fighting Gorge had been a knockdown, drag-out brawl, with three of his friends at his side, and two of them were about the toughest guys he knew. At the corner between the dining room and the foyer, they came face to face with the hostess, three men in suits, and a dazzling blonde. She wore a flattering black party dress and long black gloves. Her brilliant green eyes stood out from her flawless skin, matched by lustrous emerald jewels on her ears and neck. The three men were all Latinos. Two were tall, broad-shouldered men. One of them, Alex noticed, had a pair of teardrop tattoos under one eye. The third man wasn't exactly small, but he looked to have perhaps a decade on the other two guys, and he walked arm in arm with the blonde. She stopped in her tracks.
"Lorelai?"
"Lydia." The blonde looked her over once, simultaneously curious and disdainful.
"You look awful," she declared. "What on earth happened to you?"
"Did you two know each other?"
asked the man on Lydia's arm.
"Oh, we go back a long time,"
Lorelai answered, her eyes on Lydia. "I heard you were in town. You'll forgive me for not seeking you out. I didn't have anything new to say." Lydia frowned.
"Ah, dear Robert has been gossiping about me, has he? His lips grow so loose and indiscriminate while he's out whoring. I'll have to speak with him."
"Good luck with that,"
Lorelai replied. The Latino blinked, sensing obvious tension. Lorelai slid off of his arm to bring her hands together as she spoke, throwing out some other hardly even veiled insult. Almost unwillingly, he glanced at the young stranger with an unspoken question in his eyes. Alex went from dread to grim amusement. He would probably die over this, he realized, or at the very least he was in for a severe beating. It made for the fourth time he'd faced certain doom this week. Five, if he counted that first anguished night and day spent in fear of what could happen if he took the succubus up on her invitations. At this point, his entire life seemed absurd. To top it all off, the man trying to catch Alex's eye was almost certainly marked for death, death by sex, no less. The man leaned in and asked,
"Do you know what this is about?"
He had a subtle but distinct Mexican accent. He wasn't irate or demanding or much of anything but confused. Suppressing a grin, Alex matched the Mexican's lean and said, barely over a whisper,
"I don't know, but I don't see how this could possibly go well. They're wearing the same outfits. Chicks have to brawl if that happens, don't they?"
The Mexican's eyebrows rose as he took Alex's meaning. Apart from their jewelry, the two women were dressed alike.
"Maybe we should break this up and go our separate ways," Alex suggested.
"Really, Lorelei, you seem so much more haggard than usual," Lydia said, casting off only a little of her venom in favor of genuine curiosity. "What did you do to yourself?"
"Divorce can be brutal," Lorelei shrugged. "I am on the mend. I already feel much better for having shed so much baggage. You should try it. You'll feel much lighter. In your case, I imagine it would feel like having shaved off an entire cow."
"Divorce? Well, you do look like you belong in one of those quaint women's shelters."
Lydia turned her attention toward Alex.
"Oh, but who is your escort for this evening? He looks so young and innocent. And he's already met Carlos. Introduce us."
Those sultry green eyes bored right into him. Her grin twisted wickedly as she stepped close. Her beauty couldn't be denied, nor was she weakened like Lorelei. Lydia slid up against him, looking deeply into his eyes and breathed against his lips. Carlos and his companions pointedly said nothing. They watched with a mix of reluctance, arousal, and fascination. Carlos hated it when Lydia did this, but he could do nothing to stop her, nor could he turn his eyes away. Nothing stopped Lydia from pressing her luscious, perfectly curved body into Alex's with a predatory grin.
"I hope you don't mind a little catty talk between old girlfriends," she purred. "It's no big deal. I'm Lydia. You almost look familiar."
She stared into his eyes, and as she spoke, one gloved hand slid around to tease her fingers through Alex's hair. Onyx's warding salts had fallen through that same spot in his scalp hours before. The salt washed out in the shower, but the warding spell would last until morning. Though the spell could not block Lydia's supernatural charm, it nevertheless blunted the intensity. The rest fell to Alex's natural willpower.
"I'm someone who's already got a much hotter blonde in his life than you," Alex replied. "Now would you back up a bit? You're stepping on my dick."
Her eyes went wide with shock. Lorelei masked her surprise, but not her grin. The three Mexican gentlemen in Lydia's company all looked on as if the universe had just turned itself inside out and started playing the bagpipes. From her watchful position nearby, Rachel clamped her hand over her mouth, spun around the corner, and bumped her head against the wall twice to stifle her laughter. The blonde succubus slipped back, still completely stunned. Alex held her gaze, wanting to turn away and get the hell out, but remembering his lover's counsel.
"Weren't we leaving, Lorelei?"
He held out his hand. She took it.
"A warning, Lydia, for old time's sake," Lorelei said. "This is a dangerous city for our kind. The natives sometimes bite back. Not everyone respects the balance. You may even wind up on a new leash that you will find less pleasing than the one you wear now."
Together, Alex and Lorelei stepped past Lydia and Carlos, both of them still taken aback by the scene. The two large men in their party remained in the way, but only until Lorelei politely asked them in Spanish to move. They both blinked and made way for the couple. Almost half a minute passed before the hostess recovered her wits.
Would you like me to show you to your table?"
"Carlos," Lydia said, with a voice full of sweetness and adoration. That little brat and his whore insulted me. Shouldn't they have to say they're sorry? He hesitated, unsure of how to tell her to just get over it, or whether he even should. As always when it came to Lydia, he opted for the path of least resistance. Carlos turned to his two bodyguards.
Well?
The roads were all dark, wet, and hilly, but at least traffic was light in downtown Seattle late in the evening. Paco didn't care for being behind the wheel here, but better him than Chewie. His partner in the passenger seat provided a solid extra pair of hands and eyes, but not much else. Carlos's superiors had insisted they bring Chewie along when they came up from Mexico. It wasn't as if Paco didn't appreciate the muscle, but it would have been nice, at least, if the guy would talk about anything. Prison could turn a chatty man quiet, but Chewie's silence was just creepy. Just as well for now, Paco decided. Following the Lexus through its confusing, steep, downhill route required concentration. There were one-way streets, drivers who were lost or just stupid, and pedestrians who walked against the lights, just like the blonde waitress from back at the restaurant who crossed the street while looking right at Paco and Chewie.
Wait, what?
Paco thought. He hit the brakes and swerved just enough to miss her. Rachel whipped a pair of kitchen knives out from behind her back. She spun around in a pirouette, carving with one knife into the rolling front tire of the SUV, then slashing with the other knife against the rear tire as it followed past her. The tires burst instantly. Panicked, Paco turned the wheel entirely the wrong way. The SUV hurtled through the intersection, twisting to the side before suddenly overturning. It slid several more yards before coming to a stop in the middle of the street. Given their predicament, Paco and Chewie completely missed Rachel's touchdown dance.
And I'll just have the light garden salad, Lydia finished dismissively.
The waiter picked up the menus, thanking her, but Lydia paid no attention. She remained lost in thought until Carlos's cell phone rang.
It's the guys,
he explained. Lydia nodded, still chewing on the implications of the encounter. The bitch had left Belial's service. That much was clear from her divorce comment. But Belial would not have cast out a crown jewel like Lorelai. He might have lost her to another prince, but Lydia would have heard about the sort of upheaval that could cause such a thing. Lorelai had clearly suffered quite a thrashing. No horns, no wings, no scars either, but perhaps those had faded. She spoke of demons being hunted in the city. Perhaps that had happened to her? Could Belial have decided she was damaged beyond her worth? The look of surprise and concern on Carlos's face tore Lydia from her thoughts.
What is it? She demanded. You're gonna have to find another ride home tonight, announced a clear, amused voice.
Carlos watched a young, blonde, and beautiful waitress pull up a chair and plop down into it unceremoniously. Lydia saw her for exactly what she was.
Hi, the angel said. I'm Rachel. Sorry about your friends. I mean, not really sorry, you know, but still. Sounds like something I should say. You should tell him to be careful around here.
She tossed the two kitchen knives down onto the table.
Bunch of freaks in this town, seriously.
Ooh, hey, they brought the bread already.
She helped herself to the contents of the basket at the center of the table and swiped the butter knife from Lydia's place setting.
This place makes awesome bread. You should try it.
Who the fuck are you?
Carlos snapped. He reached out to grab the butter knife out of her hand, but in the blink of an eye, she whipped it around to wrap him across the knuckles. Stung by the blow, Carlos jerked his hand back.
I am so much more fucking trouble than you could possibly handle.
Speaking of which,
she said, gesturing at Lydia as she held his gaze, repent. Motherfucker, the end is near. For you, anyway.
What do you want?
Lydia asked through gritted teeth. Rachel spread some honeyed butter over her roll and took a bite, savoring the flavor of it.
Holy fuck, this is so good.
She grinned, with the morsel in the side of her mouth.
The angel chewed and swallowed, looking at Lydia as if she couldn't get over some private joke. I'm here to tell you I know what you're thinking, and you'd better forget about it. He's under my protection, and that means she is, too. Lydia's scowl sharpened. He cannot have a guardian angel if she is... The fuck do you think I'm doing here in the first place, you Santorum-smelling slob? Lydia blinked. What? Rachel rolled her eyes. Fucking Google it, bitch. Listen, it's real simple. That guy, the succubus, and anyone around him, off limits. Period. I even hear you've been so much as talking shit about him. My foot's gonna be so far up your ass, your mouth won't have any more room left for sucking dick. Lydia sat in stunned silence. Rachel glanced at Carlos before adding, Okay, maybe there'd still be room for one as small as his.
You can't be serious,
Lydia breathed.
The balance.
We can go right fucking now, Rachel offered menacingly. Without breaking her stare down with Lydia, she snatched the phone away from Carlos and dropped it in front of the succubus. Got any friends? Call 'em. Let's go. It was at that moment, her eyes now flitting this way and that, as she considered the situation, that Lydia realized that all of the other guardian angels in the restaurant, a couple dozen of them, all formerly just minding their individual charges, now watched the situation closely. Most seemed concerned, but more than a few looked unsettlingly eager. A couple even grinned. To stand alone against a guardian angel was folly. Doubly so against one who was so plainly, utterly mad. A demon lord could prevail, certainly, but no succubus, not even one as powerful as Lydia. And to see other guardian angels look on with such aggression in their eyes. The balance had held for centuries. It trembled now and again in one land or another, but eventually stabilized again. It looked ready to tremble here and now. Lydia knew full well that despite euphemisms, to be at the center of a tremble was the gravest of perils.
I came here tonight for dinner, Lydia said. I knew neither of her presence nor of her current state. My business does not concern the whore or her toy.
Now are you finished posturing? Rachel held her gaze for another long breath, then nodded knowingly. Good. She stood and walked away. Lydia's nails dug into the table. She opened her mouth to speak, but suddenly Rachel returned. The angel snatched up the breadbasket and a small cup of honeyed butter. This is way too good to waste on you cunts.
It would be impossible to hide away forever, Lorelai explained in the elevator. We could do it for a time. We could move to some sparsely populated corner of the globe, withdraw from society, live on my financial reserves and our love. And you would hate it, and yourself.
She held a duffel bag in one hand, and Alex's hand in the other. He had a small backpack loaded with a bit of spare clothing.
I don't know.
Alex smirked.
I'm pretty sure we could keep ourselves amused.
She smiled back at him.
Oh, you will never tire of me. But you have friends, family, dreams. You care about the people with whom you share this world. Though I would indulge you endlessly in pleasure, you need more of life than that. Thus, other demons would discover us. It was only a matter of time. And now we'll have to see how much it is worth to them to antagonize us. But I will protect you, Alex. As will Rachel, and, I think, others.
I don't like the idea of hiding behind others.
Alex frowned.
You will not. You have not. But I think you will not often find yourself standing alone.
She leaned in to kiss him until the elevator got to its appointed floor. As the doors opened, Lorelai backed off with a mischievous grin.
All that is for another time, she said.
Her eyes held his as she tugged him along. When she opened the door to the honeymoon suite, Alex couldn't help but gawk. The room was bigger than the bottom floor of his mother's townhome. The plush bed could easily accommodate more than two people. Fresh roses sat in a crystal vase on the small dining table in one corner. A plasma television hung over the fireplace, across from the foot of the bed. The balcony overlooked the waterfront and Elliott Bay.
A large Japanese whirlpool tub sat in the corner, just across from the sliding glass doors.
I had no idea this was what you meant by getting a hotel room.
I could have been more conservative. Lorelai smiled. But you agreed to let me indulge you this weekend. She shut the door behind them, threw the deadbolt, and then slipped around to his front and kissed his neck.
You indulge me just by holding my hand,
Alex told her. No need to be so humble, master. Lorelai breathed into his ear. She felt his heart begin to race. His flesh stiffened against her groin.
No master business tonight,
Alex said.
We can play with that in the morning. Tonight, I just want you to be you.
It was a tall building. Seattle had taller ones, of course. The hotel wasn't even half the height of the Columbia Tower several blocks uphill, nor was it the tallest among those closer to the water. But looking up at it from the sidewalk below, the hotel loomed more than large enough. Her borrowed waitress's uniform was gone now. Rachel stood on the sidewalk in her simple, thin white dress. No one noticed her, whether driving by or gazing out a window at the street. They didn't see the blonde angel looking up to the sky, letting raindrops fall gently on her face. Nor did they see the wings grow from her back, full and white and glorious in their spread. She felt the stirrings of their recovery while in the church, as her halo began to glow with its former brilliance. That had been alarming, seeing as Alex's greatest deeds thus far had been accomplished amid grave danger and harm. But when she caught up to him, seeing her charge and his companion getting into her car, she recognized the unmistakable look of love between them. Love was in the eyes of a demon. Rachel immediately understood why her recovery enjoyed such a sudden leap ahead. She reaped as much of a personal reward as Alex. She couldn't blame the demon, either. In mere days, Rachel had grown more attached to him than any mortal or angel she had ever known. Rachel followed them as they left his home. She didn't hear their conversations, didn't know every dynamic of their relationship. She knew the larger implications, though, and she began silently cheering them both on. In the restaurant, with Lorelai facing the sins of her past and seeking redemption, Rachel knew her recovery was essentially complete. Rachel didn't follow Lorelai into the restroom, didn't eavesdrop, but she knew. She felt it happen. Through Alex and their bond, perhaps, or, more likely, just through proximity, all the other guardian angels in the restaurant visibly perked up when it happened, too. One of Hell's most accomplished destroyers had fallen in love with a good man. Fallen in love and repented. Rachel's wings spread out, beat twice, and carried her into the air. She soared around the hotel tower. She rose and dipped and spun and looped. The angel laughed in gratitude and joy. She climbed into the air, taking her time and indulging in a broad, sweeping path, before landing silently on the balcony of the honeymoon suite. She knew where they were. She could see Alex in her mind now, whenever she concentrated, regardless of Lorelai's presence. Rachel looked in on them through the glass balcony door, unhindered by the dim light. Rachel smiled as Lorelai crawled on top of Alex, like a predatory cat toying with her prey. Her hostility toward the succubus died hours ago. On that first night, Rachel gambled on the chance that someone like Alex might be a good influence on her. But she never expected anything this profound. Now she couldn't see in Lorelai what she had seen the day before. For that matter, Rachel saw changes in herself. Lorelai had been right about her, and how she felt for her mortal charge. Jealousy simply didn't count for much in Rachel's emotional makeup, and what she saw between demon and mortal was far too important to disrupt for any reason. But she wouldn't have to come between them to claim her happiness. She thought about slipping inside with them. They would have her. She knew that. Lorelai would probably be thrilled. Rachel knew how Alex's heart swelled whenever she was near. She heard it in his voice. She saw it in his eyes, felt it in his kiss. But there was no time for that. After tonight, she would have to endure another long conversation with the angels and archangels who watched over Seattle. Oh, what fun that would be. Rachel leapt up over the ledge above to sit on the top of the building. She looked out across the bay, unbothered by either the rain or the cold. Her lips spread into a quiet smile. Eventually, she began to hum, and then finally she softly gave words to the familiar tune. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound, that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found. Was blind, but now I see. Chapter 13. The Life of the Party.
It's sinful. I'm sure my services to Christ and his holy church will make that all better, John scowled.
He finished bundling up his few clothes for easier carrying.
Do you think that will matter?
Henry pressed. The older man sat on the bench at John's table, hunched over a mug of cheap ale, all John had to offer, as he watched his young neighbor pack.
Fight the heathens, reclaim the Holy Land. Hell, walk back home wearing Christ's own shoes. You'll still be a man who abandoned his wife to another. I am not abandoning her, John snapped.
He hurled the pack of clothing at the door to his small one-room house and looked at Henry with pain and anger.
She'll be looked after. She has you, doesn't she? She has William and his family. William is exactly who I'm talking about, and you know it, John. You're a cuckolded man, and you know that too, and you do nothing about it. Do you think it's that simple?
What would you have me do, Henry? Beat her? Beat William? Murder him?
I suppose I could expose them to the ruin of his family and Catherine's good name. Do you think that would change her feelings for me? Would I find happiness in her public humiliation? She's your wife.
Because our parents arranged it.
Not because we love each other. Do you think that was on their minds when they matched us? You love her.
Henry frowned.
That's why you encouraged your father to pursue this match. You just have to be firm with her. You're the man of the house. Act like it.
Have you tried laying with a weeping woman?
Have you?
It was a rhetorical question. Henry and his wife were the most openly affectionate couple for miles.
Because I tell you, her tears do in fact leave me feeling unmanned.
Quite so.
Only an animal would react otherwise.
Her heart was never mine, Henry. She was honest enough with that. Never misled me. She loves William, and he loves her. Since before I was even a suitor, I'm just in the way. She's your wife, John. It's a sin.
Tell me how love is a sin, Henry.
John sighed painfully.
Tell me how locking up a woman who was forced to marry me and breaking her heart serves a greater good than what they have together.
Henry's silence made for a quiet house. John didn't have all that much, but with his father's untimely death from illness, it was at least his. It would be Catherine's now, though, in all but name. That was fine. John wasn't terribly worried about the family name.
You'll look in on her?
Yes. And keep your mouth shut?
Henry looked up at his friend a bit resentfully, but eventually softened.
You know I will.
John hefted up his sack of food for the road, his bundle of clothing, and the axe that had been in his family since his grandfather's time. His land would be better tended by neighbors while he was gone than he could ever manage alone. They were all happy that one of their own answered the call to take up arms for Christ and wanted to do their part in support. He had already said his goodbyes to his wife before this. She wept, confessing her sins to him, but she did not ask him to stay. She could barely bring herself to thank him, nor did she stay to see him off. John's crusade, as it turned out, became more about fighting banditry than Saracens bent on holding Jerusalem. He lived another 2 years before he met his end, seeing far more action on the journey than in the Holy Land itself. He didn't live to see Jerusalem fall, which was just as well. The aftermath would have broken his heart, almost as surely as Catherine had. John was lucky, or perhaps able to make his own luck. Men-at-arms saw fit to train him and some others to fight like warriors, rather than peasants. He traveled with real soldiers, rather than with the massive mobs of would-be crusading peasants that succeeded only in burning and murdering Jews in Europe. Several of those murdering peasants died by John's hand. It was blind luck, he maintained, that kept his name among those constantly called to keep order and enforce some measure of justice among the Duke of Normandy's men. He spent much of his time settling feuds between Christian warriors, sometimes with words and other times with violence. He put down 3 men who'd murdered their captain, and later even faced down and slew a knight who'd raped a merchant's wife, all before they reached Constantinople. He may have been a failure as a husband, but he turned out to be an excellent warrior. By the time they got to the Holy Land, it was joked around the campfire that John would have a hard time slaughtering Saracens enough to equal the number of Christians he'd killed. In the end, the joke proved all too accurate. He fought only a few battles against the Saracens. He rarely had time or energy for plunder. The more he saw of the Holy Land, the more he wondered if his heart was truly in the quest. He fought heroically at Antioch, but his final battle came in the hours following the taking of the city. Rather than Saracens, he once again faced his own kind. In those wild streets, John found a French noblewoman with several men-at-arms and a clutch of cowering Saracen girls. The woman had drifted from one lord to the next throughout the journey. John never rightly knew who she was or where she'd come from. Her beauty alone explained why she was allowed to come along, for it seemed that no one could deny her anything. He'd never seen such striking green eyes or golden blonde hair. John found her unsettling, but she had no time for one as lowly as him. She accused the girls of swallowing jewels to hide them from their conquerors. She instructed the men-at-arms to retrieve them in any way necessary. John asked his comrades how they thought they would find the kingdom of God by slitting the bellies of defenseless women. It came to heated words and then blows. He fought well. John was quicker, smarter, and sober. The 3 girls ultimately walked away from the matter, as did only 2 of the 6 crusaders present. The others fell to John's sword. He nearly defeated them all. The strangely beautiful noblewoman, standing behind him with a dagger, intervened before the last 2 men-at-arms died at his hand. John did not walk away from that dispute. He had friends. He was avenged, at least where the other 2 men he'd fought were concerned. No one spoke of the noblewoman. She disappeared after the fall of Jerusalem and was soon forgotten. John's belongings and treasures in pay, in defiance of all the cynical realities of the time, actually made it home to Normandy. It was enough to provide a real measure of security. His wife had given birth to a child within 9 months of his departure, who came to bear John's name. No one ever accused Catherine of bearing another man's son. Nor did Catherine ever tell anyone that on their wedding night, John had dried her tears and promised to never take her without her consent. Nor did anyone speak ill when, a year after John's death and that of William's first wife, widow and widower were married. John died shortly after the blonde woman tore his wedding band from his hand. His last thoughts, as he bled out from a dagger in his back, in the dirty streets of Antioch, were of his wife. His last prayer was that Catherine would live a long, happy life full of love. She did. Alex remembered nothing of his dreams that morning. They fled from his mind in the first seconds of his waking, distracted as he was by Lorelai making love to him with her kiss alone. Lorelai could share only in dreams of his desires. He had several about her that left her feeling properly appreciated. She didn't dwell much on the other disjointed, fleeting images that ran through his unconscious mind in between. She paused in her attentions just long enough to murmur sweetly, "Good morning, my love." Alex stretched out in the bed without opening his eyes. "Master," he corrected with a grin. He felt her body, draped over his legs, tense, and hold him tighter as she responded to the word. "Oh," she grinned widely. "Now he wants to play." Even in heaven, everyone loved a good scandal. Immortal beings who saw each minute and day pass no faster or slower than the mortal world knew how to savor small things. Events in Seattle hardly threatened to reshape the world, but they still made for great gossip. Nothing this juicy had happened since the end of the First World War. The informal Congress of Angels grew in numbers overnight. A great many of the seraphim descended from heaven, along with no small number of the Ophanim. Angelic lords and heavenly bureaucrats attended as well, since their responsibilities could be put on hold. For the guardian angels, it was somewhat the reverse. They were greater in overall number, but only a small portion could step away from their charges for long. Some angels, particularly the lords and Ophanim, took everything seriously. Others, such as the seraphim, tittered and speculated and made a big deal of everything. The guardians were a mixed bag, but in having constant contact with human diversity, this was no great surprise. Some found the events in Seattle alarming. Others saw them as a sign of hope, or at least a reaffirmation of purpose. So many attended that the meeting moved to St. Mark's Cathedral, a landmark building on Capitol Hill overlooking Lake Union. That Saturday morning, the sun shone brightly through scattered clouds as angels stood all over the grounds, talking about both current events and their vastly intertwined pasts. Much of that conversation stopped at the wordless arrival of a proud, triumphant guardian angel. No one expected to see her come in from above. She flew down from the skies, under her broad, glorious wings. Many angels were shocked by her appearance. Many guardians cheered at her recovery. They looked on with interest as the lovely blonde landed and strode to the doors of the cathedral. Rachel faded through the front doors without opening them, swaggering into the foyer. "What up, gangsta?" she waved to those who passed. Coming to the doors to the chapel, Rachel felt no reason to be shy or subtle. She grabbed the handles and threw them both open wide. As she expected, conversation stopped. Angels in her path parted like the Red Sea. Toward the altar, she saw Hannah, Lawrence, Vincent, Caleb, and others. She threw her arms and wings wide, calling out, "How you like me now, bitches?" Eyes popped, jaws dropped, hands flew over mouths. "Y'all felt that sudden, unprecedented shift in the battle of good and evil? That motherfucker's all mine. That's my boy, that's his chica, and that is all my good judgment." "What?" She looked directly at Vincent, who seemed like he was about to speak. "What? What you got to say about that?"
"Rachel, you..."
"What?" Rachel bellowed over him tauntingly. A wide grin dominated her face.
"I was going to..."
"What?"
"Please stop."
"What?" Vincent gave up trying to speak with a scowl. The taller, grander angel beyond him, facing away from the conversation at first, now turned to look upon Rachel. She stopped taunting. "Oh," she said, straightening up. She made an awkward wave with an even more awkward self-conscious smile. "Hello, Mr. Archangel Michael, sir?" Lydia despised having to wait for nightfall, but that was simply the nature of the beast. She was used to getting what she wanted when she wanted it, or at least seeing others immediately hop to satisfying her whims. Sometimes, though, the realities of life meant that things had to run on their own schedule. Hours ago, the sketch artist Carlos found for her had arrived at their luxurious Capitol Hill home. He fit the bill precisely as she'd hoped, young, hungry, talented, and sinful enough that no guardian angel looked after him. Lydia put him straight to work. Before long, she had solid, effective likenesses of Lorelei and her brat, not that any sketch could truly capture the beauty of the succubus. Lydia also had the young artist completely, utterly enraptured. She allowed him to kneel before her, as she sat in a chair in the study, slavishly licking between her spread legs while she pondered her options. The artist wasn't as talented as Carlos, nor was he good as Paco, or Chewy, or several of the other bodyguards here in Seattle, or Carlos's father, or a couple of Carlos's rivals within the family business. Still, he offered up at least a casual degree of pleasure. Lydia sat wearing her short, green silk bathrobe, with only its bottom spread open for her new servant's access. She gave him no outward indication of excitement, letting him wonder if he pleased her. She had already forgotten his name. He looked up at her, longing for some sort of approval or appreciation, or even just a glance of acknowledgement, but he was out of luck. She genuinely wasn't thinking about him at all. Instead, she considered changes in her plans. After her wedding to Carlos in Ciudad Juarez a month ago, Lydia grew eager to wrap things up with him. She had made more than enough inroads with his allies in the cartel to use them at her whim in the future. Carlos was overdue in hell. Only Lydia's curiosity about his cartel's expansion into the Pacific Northwest kept him alive this long. She was about ready to claim her final satisfaction from him. Manipulating him and cuckolding him at every turn had grown a touch dull. She'd turned him into a fine lover, of course, but that would happen for her next prey, too. She meant to tell him at dinner last night about her rampant infidelities, eager for the inevitable bloodshed that would follow, all the adorable violence and anguish and discord that erupted whenever one of her lovers found her in bed with another simply never got old. But then she found Lorelei. No horns, no wings, and absolutely no shame about it. The hostility was no surprise, but for one of Belial's whores, even one so infamous, to take on such an arrogant and dismissive tone to the most favored of Baal was intolerable. Lydia's unanswered questions were intolerable, too. Carlos and his stooges, while very useful in a number of roles, were perhaps not up to the task of stalking an accomplished succubus. Even a demon could risk only so much bleed over between mortal and supernatural matters. Thus, she needed intermediaries, as distasteful as those available here in Seattle might be. Perhaps an hour after sunset, she heard a knock at the door. Lydia put a hand on her new pet's head to keep him going. "Who is there?" she asked.
"It's Paco."
"Enter," Lydia beckoned. Though Paco did his best to keep a straight face, the sight of another man on his hands and knees servicing her put him through emotional chaos. He felt both arousal and furious jealousy, bad enough that he had to put up with her husband, and humiliation. Paco had to fight off the urge to shoot the boy right then and there, and Lydia knew it. Lydia smiled at Paco sweetly. She kept the artist going about his deed. He had her nowhere near satisfaction. But this small rush of cruelty made up for that.
"What is it, Paco?"
she asked. Paco gritted his teeth. He'd swallow his pride, she knew, and that cultivated machismo of his, because she was that damned amazing. Her lovers never focused their ire on her, but rather their rivals. The sketch artist might not make it home alive, but his work was done.
"You've got people here to see you,"
Paco said in Spanish.
"Excellent,"
she said.
"Have you heard from Carlos yet?"
She utterly ignored the artist.
"He called. He said to tell you he'd be home late tonight."
"Very good. Can you describe our guests?"
Three people, two men, one woman. They're all dressed in black, freely clothes,"
Paco said, trying to find words. He stared daggers at the head between Lydia's legs. "Really pale.
They seem stuck up and annoying."
"Yes, that's just what I expected."
Lydia sighed. She shifted in her chair. The artist leaned back, looking up like a lost puppy as she rose.
"Have you made them comfortable?"
"I asked them to wait in the living room, yes."
"Good. I'll throw something on before I go down there."
She gathered the sketches before she glanced down at the kneeling young man.
"What was your name again? Albert? Adam?"
"Webster."
"Oh, right. Paco, could you show Webster out? Best if you use the back entrance."
Paco waited until Lydia left before he hauled Webster up by the ear. Minutes later, Lydia descended the ornate staircase in a form-fitting, full-length crimson dress. She had considered jeans and tall boots. This wouldn't be far off from stepping in something distasteful. Still, what had to be done had to be done. Waiting in the living room were her three guests. One of the men stood in jeans, a button-down shirt, and a leather sport coat, all of it black, of course, with his hands folded at his belt buckle and his eyes hidden behind black sunglasses. His black, spiky hair and fashionable sideburns framed a pale, thuggish face. The other two rose as Lydia arrived. They came dressed with something beyond formality in mind. The man seemed like a grave, all-black peacock, clad in shining black leather pants and a frilly black poet's shirt. He tossed his head to clear his long black hair from his vision. His companion,